Mind and Body Reset, Modern Wellness Decoded. Science-backed wellness made simple.
Have you ever walked out of an air-conditioned building on a hot summer day and felt like you've hit a wall of heat? Not just from the sun, but from the pavement, the buildings, the very air itself. It's a feeling I know all too well. I remember a summer in New York, walking through Midtown, and the heat felt aggressive, trapped. Then, just a few blocks later, I stepped into Central Park, and the temperature drop was so immediate, so palpable, it felt like I'd crossed into another climate. That feeling has stuck with me for years.
It's so true. For me, it's always been this fascination with how we design our lives, our cities, and how that design, in turn, designs us. It shapes our moods, our health, our stress levels. I've been reading so much lately about the science of nature's impact on our brains, and I keep coming back to this question. In a world that's becoming more urban, more concrete, are we accidentally engineering the nature right out of our own well-being?
And that is the heart of our conversation today. We're not just talking about a hot day, we're talking about a phenomenon known as the urban heat island effect. How our cities are becoming significantly warmer than the surrounding natural landscapes, and the profound, often invisible, impact this is having on our physical and mental health.
But this isn't just about the problem. It's about a solution. A solution that's surprisingly simple, deeply ancient, and backed by a growing body of modern science. We're going to explore how an intentional practice, something called forest bathing, can be a powerful antidote to the stress of city life.
So, the question we're asking today is, in the concrete jungles we call home, can we find a way to reconnect with nature, to heal ourselves and our cities? We'll delve into the science of heat stress, we'll talk to experts, and we'll uncover practical ways to find your own oasis, no matter where you live.
It's a conversation about resilience, wellness, and the remarkable power of the natural world. Stick with us.
So to really get at the heart of this, we have to understand what's physically happening. That wall of heat I felt in New York, it's not an illusion. It's a measurable phenomenon. And a huge part of it, nearly 40%, comes from something we rarely think about. The color of our roofs.
The color of our roofs. It sounds so simple, but when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. It's like choosing to wear a black wool coat on a sunny day. We've essentially dressed our cities in heat-absorbing materials.
That's the perfect analogy. Scientists call it the albedo effect. A dark surface, like traditional asphalt or a dark roof, absorbs a huge percentage of the sun's radiation and converts it into heat. A lighter surface reflects it, and we have built entire cities out of dark, low-albedo materials.
And it's not just the roofs. It's the roads, the vast parking lots, endless miles of blacktop, just drinking in the sun all day, and then radiating that heat back out all night.
Exactly. Which is why cities don't cool down at night the way a rural area does. The concrete and asphalt have stored all that energy. They become giant thermal batteries, slowly releasing heat. In some cities, that can mean a difference of up to 5 degrees Celsius. That's a 9 degree Fahrenheit difference. It's significant. It's huge. But it's a two-part problem, isn't it? It's not just what we've added, the asphalt, the concrete. It's also what we've taken away.
The trees. The green spaces.
Right. A single healthy deciduous tree is like a biological air conditioner. Through a process called evapotranspiration, it pulls water up from its roots and releases it as vapor through its leaves, actively cooling the air around it. We're talking a reduction in air temperatures of up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
10 degrees! And that's not even counting the shade. The surface temperature of asphalt and direct sun can be scorching, but under a tree canopy, it can be 20, even 45 degrees cooler.
So you have this compounding effect. We add heat-absorbing materials and remove the natural cooling systems, and our bodies are caught in the middle. This isn't just about comfort. It's a public health issue. This sustained heat puts an incredible strain on the human body.
How does that work exactly? What is happening inside us when we're in that environment day after day?
Well, our bodies are constantly working to maintain a stable internal temperature. When we're in extreme heat, the cardiovascular system has to work much, much harder. Your heart beats faster. Your blood vessels dilate to bring more blood to the skin to release heat. You sweat, you lose fluids and electrolytes.
So it's a constant, low-level stress test.
A relentless one. For someone with a pre-existing condition, heart disease, asthma, diabetes, it can be incredibly dangerous. But even for a perfectly healthy person, this chronic thermal stress takes a toll. It disrupts sleep, which affects everything else.
And I have to imagine it goes beyond the purely physical. I know for myself, when I'm overheated, my patience is thin. My ability to think clearly just plummets. There's a mental fog that sets in.
There is. And the research is really starting to bear this out. Studies have shown correlations between high temperatures and increased irritability, aggression, and even spikes in violent crime. Our cognitive functions suffer. Our decision-making gets worse. We are literally not the same people when we are overheated.
So, we've designed these urban environments that not only make our cities hotter, but also put our bodies and our minds under a constant invisible siege. It's a design flaw with profound consequences, and it's one that disproportionately impacts the most vulnerable people in those cities. That's a crucial piece of this we have to talk about.
It is the crucial piece, because this heat isn't distributed evenly. It's not a blanket that covers the city equally. It pools and concentrates. And when you map where those heat islands are most intense, you almost always find they overlap with maps of lower-income neighborhoods and communities of color.
So it's not just a matter of geography. It's a matter of history, of policy.
Precisely. There's a term for it, thermal inequity. And it's often a direct legacy of historical planning decisions. You can look at maps from the 1930s, the old redlining maps that designated certain neighborhoods as hazardous for investment, largely based on race.
Oh, wow. And I'm guessing those are the same neighborhoods that today have
fewer parks, less tree canopy, more asphalt, more industrial zoning right next to residential areas. Decades later, the legacy of that disinvestment is literally baked into the environment. You can measure it with a thermometer on a summer afternoon.
That is staggering. So, a discriminatory housing policy from nearly a century ago means a child living in that same neighborhood today is at a higher risk for asthma and heat stroke.
That is the direct physical reality of it. And think about the cascading effects. If you live in one of these hotter neighborhoods, your electricity bill for air conditioning is going to be significantly higher. That's a financial burden that falls hardest on those who can least afford it.
And what if you can't afford to run the AC, or you don't have it? I'm thinking of elderly people living alone in older brick buildings that just soak up the heat. They're trapped.
They are. And this leads to another concept researchers talk about: space poverty. It's not just about the size of your apartment. It's about your access to safe, comfortable, and cool spaces. If your home is an oven, and the streets outside are scorching,
you go to the park. I mean, that's what I did in New York. You just said it yourself. You escape to Central Park.
But what if the nearest park is a mile away, and you have to walk across blistering pavement to get there? What if it's not well maintained? For many people, that escape is out of reach. The park becomes a privilege, not a public utility.
So the very solution we're talking about, connecting with nature, is itself unequally distributed. It's a resource that's been withheld from the very communities that need it most. It's infuriating, actually.
It is. And it creates this feedback loop. The environmental stress exacerbates social and economic stress. It impacts children's ability to learn. Studies have shown test scores drop during heat waves. It impacts community health.
It makes me wonder about the psychological toll. We talked about the irritability, The mental fog. What happens when that's your baseline for 3 or 4 months of the year? When your own environment feels fundamentally hostile. It's not just a physical siege. It's an emotional one.
An emotional siege. That's exactly what it is. And when you're under siege, you need more than just physical relief. You need a sanctuary. You need a place to exhale. And I think that brings us full circle, back to the promise we made at the very beginning of this conversation.
Yes, the antidote, forest bathing. It sounds a little esoteric, maybe, but it's so incredibly simple and profound. It's not about hiking or exercise. It's about presence. It's the Japanese practice of Shinrin Yoku, which literally just means bathing in the forest atmosphere.
And the science behind it is just catching up to the intuition. When you're in a forest, or even just around trees, you're breathing in these airborne compounds called phytosides, which are essentially the tree's natural defense system. And studies are showing that inhaling these can lead to a measurable decrease in stress hormones like cortisol, a lower heart rate, lower blood pressure.
It's like your body recognizes it. It's like, oh, right, this is where I'm supposed to be. You're not just getting shade, you're getting this chemical signal to your nervous system to calm down, to switch from that fight-or-flight mode that the city puts you in to a state of rest and recovery.
Which is so critical when your environment is creating that constant low-level stress we talked about. But here's the thing that I keep coming back to, and I wonder if you see it this way. I love this idea, this practice, as a tool for personal resilience. But I also get a little concerned.
Oh? How so?
I worry that it places the burden of the solution back on the individual. We've just spent all this time talking about systemic failures, redlining, thermal inequity, space poverty. Is it fair to then say, well, the answer is for you to go find a tree? It feels like we're treating a symptom, not the cause.
I hear that. I really do. But I don't see them as mutually exclusive. I see it as a both-and situation. The systemic change, the green roofs, the urban planning, the investment in parks, that is the long game. It's essential. It's the goal. But people are suffering right now, today. And the act of seeking out and connecting with that one tree in a concrete lot or that small community garden, that's not just self-care. It's an act of defiance.
An act of defiance. I like that. Explain that a bit more.
It's reclaiming your right to well-being in an environment that is actively hostile to it. And maybe, just maybe, when enough people start to feel the profound difference that even a small pocket of nature makes in their lives, they become the fiercest advocates for the big systemic changes. It builds the political will from the ground up.
So, the personal practice fuels the public demand. You're saying the micro-solution and the macro-solution are part of the same feedback loop. One can't really exist without the other. We need the immediate personal relief to have the energy to fight for the long-term structural change.
That's what I believe. It's about building resilience not just in our bodies, but in our communities. It starts with one person, one breath under one tree, and it grows from there.
It's a powerful thought to end on, that the path to healing our cities, these vast, complex, overheated systems, might just begin with something as quiet and personal as listening to the sound of wind in the leaves.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to leave it for today. Thank you for listening and for joining us on this journey from the macro problem to the micro solution. We hope it's given you something to think about. And maybe a reason to go find your own little patch of green.